Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
Hi there, JB. How are you doing?
Very well, Jan. Thank you.
It's good to have a chance to talk to you again. It's been a long time, and I didn't realize how ill you'd been in the meantime.
Well, it seems to have plateaued off. Leveled up pretty good, so I'm still hanging in there.
Well, that's excellent. I must tell you, over here in Southern Africa, there's not a Rhodesian who talks about that war. They don't say a thing. And I think the most recent book that I've seen two books that have come out in the last 10 years. Books that I hadn't seen when I had done the last interview with you. There was an excellent book from a Rhodesian Air Force guy that came out in about 2013. All the last good stuff came out around about 2012, 2013. And then it seemed to me the Rhodesians went on some kind of propaganda thing. And they went and they got some journalist, I think it was some European journalist who'd also been in Rhodesia, and they wrote another book. I've got it somewhere here. And that book was, to me, a whole propaganda piece. It's something about Rhodesia, a brutal affair. And they were almost like excusing themselves and they didn't mean to do it and this and that. And I was like reading it. I could have puked because, I mean, you were there, and there are some other topics that I'd like to talk to you about in another show.
That's too bad.
But I mean, these people were basically implying that they weren't really racists. And I mean, you and I know the things that were going on there. And I was like, no, man, this particular book. And you know what? In the book, they've got other additional good data that I'd never seen before. But in this liberal fucking ass kissing, sucking up to the blacks kind of format, the whole thing really ticked me off. I think I read the book about halfway, and I really struggled with the fucking thing. I was looking for additional data, which there is, but man, it was the most pathetic I've ever seen the Rhodesians, and the old colonel that I had been talking to. He might even be dead now. He might even be dead because I spoke to him several months ago and he wasn't talking much and he'd already been in hospital. And I sent an email maybe 2 months ago and nobody's replying. So I think all my contacts are gone. And there are guys who are still alive. There are guys who were high ranking, man. One of them was a guy who, when he came to South Africa after the war, he was a South African, I think, in Rhodesia. And when he came back to South Africa, he became a general in South Africa. And I asked for access to these people, and nobody wants to talk to me. So I've just given up. I've given the fuck up. You're the last guy who's talking. And you're the only one who'll hit into the hectic topics that nobody's wanted to talk about. It's really been quite frustrating. And we're losing history because these people are alive. They could tell you stuff. They could tell you stuff. They could go down in the historical record, etc. Anyway, yeah. So yeah. It's a loss for everyone.
I've had the same experience. My colleagues at Support Unit won't talk about it because, you know, we were in charge of Joshua Nkrumah, and that's kind of a tough pill to swallow.
Were you still in touch with them?
Yeah, two or three of them.
Until when?
About 5 years ago, it ended.
Oh, really? It ended for you then as well, then.
They
Okay.
just won't talk about it. They won't, you know, they won't, we can't compare notes because they won't tell what they did.
I'm with you. I'm with you. Oh, it's so fucking frustrating.
Well, it's a dirty chapter. It's embarrassing to the ones who put everything into it and see what they got, see what they accomplished. Nothing at the end.
Well, don't worry. South Africa's also got all its stuff. So I'm busy also rereading some South African history at the moment, and picking up new data as well as just refreshing my memory. The whites everywhere. The whites set out to do some pretty awesome stuff, but it's terrible that it's lost and that everyone's hiding, because it's like German history in World War II, where David Irving was the only one who managed to get some of those people to give diaries and things that would otherwise have never seen the light of day. And it's dreadful the things that disappear quietly into history because people are too scared to tell anybody, or if they tell somebody, they tell somebody, it's all hushed up and it's gone. Like, one thing I know is that the Rhodesians, when I was talking to that colonel, the Rhodesians took all the Rhodesian files, and all the Rhodesian files were handed over to Britain. So you must know that's gone to Britain. It went to the British Army, and that stuff. What the Brits do and what the Brits ever let out, we will never know. So I'm sure there's lots and lots of stuff that's lost anyway. But let's hit the topic that we wanted to discuss today, which is when you were finished with Rhodesia and you left Rhodesia and you went back to America. I believe you at a point decided to write a book. As best I can recall, I think the name of the book was The New American Man, and that book contained lessons that you'd learned from Rhodesia that you were trying to warn the whites in America based on your experiences in Africa. So please tell me what you did and how it worked out.
Well, that's true. The point of the book for me was that I was trying to recreate the camaraderie that we had in Rhodesia, in America. And I learned the hard way that's just really not possible. We're Americans are too different than Rhodesians. And there were, I'm not a fan of England, as you probably know, but the English speaking Rhodesians, where I was in Mount Darwin, Bindura, they were wonderful, and so were the Dutch. But the crisis brought us together. They gave us a great camaraderie, but America doesn't have that, and I don't suppose ever could.
That is a fascinating thing. I've thought back many times myself to what I remember about Rhodesia, and the one thing I miss the most as well is that camaraderie that you talk about. It was a whole different thing to this modern time, where we're all in trouble, but we know that we're sticking together and we're all in it together. And for me, it was never the same again. South Africa had a little bit of it among the Afrikaans speakers, but nobody had it like up in Rhodesia. It
No.
You know what I think is, I think the only people who experienced the same thing and maybe even more of it were the Germans. I think the Germans had, I think the Germans in World War II had a lot more of, had a lot of that.
I agree.
From what I've picked up.
They were very human, very warm people.
Yeah. So what did you put, what did you put in your book? What were you trying to, what topics? Because I've looked for copies of your book. I can't find it anywhere. I can't even find catalog entries of your book. I can't find anything of your book. So what happened with your book and what did you try to put into it? Because it's terrible that it seems to be lost and nobody seems to have a copy and no copies exist.
Yeah, there, I've talked to a couple of guys. Of course, our friend Lonnie has one. It's certainly my last one. I don't even have one myself. A couple of the guys admit to having it. It is, I think, you'd say, honestly, it's a unique book. Because it's probably the only one that I've ever heard of that calls for the assassination of traitors in this country, in the U.S. government. The first six chapters are justifications for the last chapter, which is called Countervail, which calls for the selective assassination of traitors. Mostly in the Council on Foreign Relations. People call it the deep state these days. It's a cowardly term. It means nothing. But you got to put the blame where it deserves to be, and that's on the Council on Foreign Relations, which has had control of our this government here since even before it was formed in 1921. They were the guys that were handling Woodrow Wilson. And there's so much damage to this country and to the world. But anyway, that was the basis of the book was to punish treason.
That's interesting. Other people in America that I know have brought up the issue of treason. There was a guy called Ton Staffel, and he had a website that was called The Age of Treason. And Tom Metzger, I don't know if you know or knew Tom Metzger, but
I knew who he was.
Tom Metzger, I know he had a cartoon. He called it, I've got a copy of the cartoon. He called it the Tom Metzger workout, and it's got a rope and it's got a politician that looks a lot like Henry Kissinger. and he talks about how you gotta hang him. And you know, when I look at all the things that are happening in your country and I look at the Jews and what the Jews are up to, at the end of the day, it all boils down to the Jews wouldn't make any progress whatsoever if they didn't have whites committing treason. And treason is the, I agree with you, treason is the main thing in the USA. And I think that some of them actually believe that the treason they're committing is for the good of America or for the good of mankind. They are all confused and screwed up, but it comes, the influence originally seems to be Jewish and from these secret societies like and Hillary Clinton. She also said something about, she referred to the Council on Foreign Relations as the mothership. The mothership.
Right. Yeah, she was giving a little talk at the CFR in the new one in Washington, because you know the CFR started in New York, then they had one in Chicago, then they had a new one open up in Washington, D.C., just down the street from the White House. She was saying how much more convenient it was to have one nearby so that they tell her what to think and what to say about things. as you referred to it, as a mothership, being the one in New York.
Oh, wow. Now, who exactly is behind that Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, of course, in 1921, when it was formed, it was a Colonel House, Colonel Edward Mandel House, the great eminence behind Woodrow Wilson, who picked Woodrow Wilson in 1912 to become the Democrat candidate for president. And the Dulles brothers, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, their uncle, Robert Lansing, who was the Secretary of State under Wilson, Walter Lippmann, and a lot of the Henry Kissingers of their day, made up this thing called the Council on Foreign Relations, which was financed by the Rothschild and Rockefeller fortunes, always has been, always will be. And that's where our foreign policy is made, because it's called Council on Foreign Relations. The idea being America should just be one of many countries in the United Nations. In those days, it was going to be the League of Nations, but the U.S. Senate finally decided not to allow the U.S. to join the League of Nations. So these malcontents, the Dulles brothers, Colonel House, and the others were enraged. So they formed a CFR in New York, and for 19 years they plotted and devised a way to get America into a real world war, out of which membership in a world body would be guaranteed, and it was the United Nations organization. But that was the task of the CFR. Since then, it makes, of course, domestic policy here, as well as foreign policy.
Now, I've been doing other reading. There was a guy in America called Professor Carol Quigley, and one of his students at university was Bill Clinton, and Clinton even mentioned him. And Quigley wrote a number of interesting books, and he also spoke about money, but he spoke about how the money came from South Africa, originally from Cecil John Rhodes, who then formed a secret society. And then this also moved into America. And I'm not sure if that also is somehow linked to the Council on Foreign Relations. But what he had was, he spoke about how these people via Britain, they made huge amounts of money in South Africa. Then via Britain, they started infiltrating America. And it also messes around with America. There are some other points. It might come to me as we talk further. But Quigley is interesting because he comes up with a lot of liberal stuff, and liberals in America love him. They love him. He's like a god. And I went through quite a bit of his stuff.
Yeah, it's true. He wrote the famous book, I'm losing it right now in my mind, but the title of that. Anyway, he wrote another one called The Anglo-American Establishment. And that explains...
Yes, yes.
Really better than the other one, the famous one, how this conspiracy works. But I'm glad he called it The Anglo-American, because it's British and American.
The other one you're probably thinking of is Tragedy and Hope.
Yeah, that's the one. That's difficult to read, but it's valuable in an academic sort of way. But once you have these things under your belt and you've looked at these things, it's time for action. There's just so much study and so much analyzing you need to do before you have to go from there into action. My father knew that I was pretty hot back in the early 70s, and he said, you better get out of the country, because I was told him I had to kill Henry Kissinger. So that's what really why I decided to go back to Rhodesia after that business trip I was on in 71. Went back in 70, the end of 72. So I felt I needed more experience before I
undertook this. Are you saying that you wanted to kill Henry Kissinger?
Yeah, that was my plan. When I came back from Rhodesia, I decided to get a bit more ambitious and to go for David Rockefeller. And I was arrested and prosecuted because of my own carelessness. Somebody had supplied me with a Thompson submachine gun, which was clean, very clean, and I could leave it at the scene. I had information from another guy on the whereabouts of David Rockefeller. So I was training this buddy of mine to go with me. He insisted he go with me. I said, okay, you don't know much about firearms, but I'll give you some training. And here's what you will do. And unfortunately, we were arrested at this out in the park where we were shooting. It was very remote, and it led to a year of prosecution. I finally beat the rap. We both did, due to technicality. And that's when I decided I'm not doing this lone wolf thing. Isn't working for me. I've got to get some help. That's when I decided to write the book. And the book was going to be in support of the Second Amendment. And I had to do some research. The more research I did, the worse the Second Amendment looked because of this horrible expression, a well-regulated militia. I thought, well, what does that mean, well-regulated militia? And I undertook to research this idea. I found out that, for one thing, nobody in the Constitution is authorized to regulate the militia. The Army, yes, the Navy, yes, but not the militia. It's unregulated. So that was the task of the traitors, to somehow disarm the militia. I found that the militia really never really had any basis at all because it couldn't be regulated. So I looked at about 54 cases from the U.S. Code annotated. And every time a guy was prosecuted for a gun charge, which, you know, the wording of the Second Amendment is very deceptive. It's got an independent clause and a dependent clause. The independent clause is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But the dependent clause is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's a totally inappropriate clause. The amendment should have been simply, the right of the people to keep their arms shall not be infringed. Forget the well-regulated militia, because well-regulated militia means a controlled militia. It's a abomination, that's the whole idea. But then it's an abomination on top of another one, because the whole Bill of Rights is unnecessary, except to protect us from the Constitution. The Constitution is the problem, not the solution. The Constitution was devised by these guys called Federalists. They gave us the Constitution. They also gave us the Bill of Rights, reluctantly, 4 years later. But the Constitution is a seven-part program on how to run the central government, which is not what the rebels fought for against England. They fought under the Articles of Confederation. So these rich aristocrats went to Philadelphia, supposedly to modify the Articles of Confederation there's something a little bit more powerful. They abandoned that. They ditched the articles, and based on their Masonic Lodge rules of order, they came up with the Constitution, which the rebels never heard of when they were fighting that for freedom from English tyranny. The whole thing is a deception. America is built on a deception. And that was really what I discovered while I was writing this book, and it was quite amazing to me what I discovered. But the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment, the whole bit, the militia. What I did was I jammed that militia right up the government's ass. Because what I started was the militia movement. That's totally different than the militia. The militia is a myth. The militia movement was kind of a trick. I knew that American patriots wanted to believe in something. I knew that they wanted to hang their hat on something traditional and real. So I said, okay, let's be in the militia. We'll overthrow the government. Because I researched the Militia Act of 1792 and found out that one of the reasons for the militia, according to this Militia Act of 1792, was to suppress combinations too powerful for the ordinary course of judicial proceeding, which means like the CFR or the Justice Department or the FBI or the CIA. These are combinations, what they called in those days. And they're criminal combinations. And they're too powerful for the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. So that's how I justified calling forth the militia to overthrow these traitors. That was the basis of the book. And we can say, honestly now, that I was the first American to turn Americans against the American government, as far as I know.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, that's what I did. And by 1993, the government of the United States estimated that there were about 5 or 6 million men in this country who considered themselves to be in this militia movement. Which is huge. Huge. Very significant.
That's incredible.
That was the time of Waco, when the Waco pilgrims were burned to death, attacked viciously by the ATF, and finally burned to death by the FBI and the U.S. Army. But that caused the militia movement to explode. Even bigger than the 5 or 6 million. Until 2 years later, when the Oklahoma City building was exploded by the FBI and the U.S. Army, and the militia movement died literally overnight because it was so horrendous. Because Timothy McVeigh, who was an Army agent, FBI-controlled Army agent, according to Terry Nichols, he said that his co-conspirator, Timothy McVeigh, was controlled by an FBI executive named Larry Potts. Well, that died. And Nichols hasn't been allowed to speak ever since. But McVeigh was, McVeigh, in his trial, a letter to his sister was read by his sister, Jennifer. She said that Timothy McVeigh, despite the reports, had gone from the Army to the Special Forces, which is a CIA-controlled military wing of the United States military. CIA-controlled, though. Special Forces, Green Berets, SEAL teams. These are units that the CIA controls secretly. Timothy McVeigh was working for the CIA-controlled covert tactical unit he assumed when he wrote to his sister that he was going to be working against drug dealers. And he said, we'll be breaking the law, but you got to do this to get these guys. But he had nothing to do with the drug dealers. He had to pretend to be in the militia so that when he was caught, it would bring the militia down. Because the 168 people, 40 of them, about 40 of them were children of the federal employees in Oklahoma City. And it was so horrendous and so horrible that anybody who thought he was in the militia movement quickly said, I never heard of the militia because of Timothy McVeigh. But that's how the U.S. government operates. Everything the Clintons did, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Janet Reno, Louis Freeh, the FBI, everything they tried to do made the militia movement bigger and bigger until that desperate atrocity brought down that building with a number of bombs. I'm sure McVeigh's truck bomb had something go off in it, but what we don't know. But the real bombs were inside the building. And it just, obliterated much of the building. 168 people were killed and blamed on the militia movement. My own mother thought I was involved in it. So why would you think that? Well, the militia did it, and you started the militia. I said, the militia didn't do that. That was the Army. The U.S. Army did that. But anyway, that's the nature of the struggle in this country. A lot more complicated than it was in Rhodesia.
Very. And there are many things that you've mentioned here in this chat. I just want to jump around on some of the points that you mentioned. That thing of your original plan to assassinate Kissinger, and then you decided to go after Rockefeller. Why Rockefeller? Why did you regard Rockefeller as more dangerous than Kissinger?
Well, he was the paymaster. He was the one who financed everything. He admitted in a... Let me get a little sip of water here because my mouth is dried out.
Okay.
David Rockefeller admitted in his last years to have been behind the subversion of America. He gave his appreciation to the news media who attended CFR and trilateral meetings, never reported on them. He said, without your help, we never could have pulled this off. You could find this online. These Rockefeller boys were unbelievable. Nelson Rockefeller, his brother, wanted to be president of the United States more than anything. And when Winthrop Rockefeller, who was the governor of Arkansas and reputed to be the actual father of Bill Clinton, when he was going through his divorce with his wife, Bobo Sears Rockefeller, she testified during the divorce proceedings that the Rockefeller brothers would get together every now and then and spitball, dream up ways to put Nelson in the White House without the formality of being elected. Of course, that's what we got when Nixon was forced out. Before that, before he went, Spiro Agnew, the vice president, was forced out under threat of death by Alexander Haig. And then we got Gerry Ford to replace Nixon. And Gerry Ford picked Nelson Rockefeller to be his vice president. That's a period in America, the only time we've had a president and a vice president at the same time, neither one of whom was elected. It's unbelievable. That was the typical way that Winthrop Rockefeller, or Bobo Sears Rockefeller, said that the Rockefeller brothers would spitball these preposterous schemes to get Nelson into the White House without being elected. I mean, if those two Manson girls who shot at Gerry Ford had been successful, instead of blowing their shots, we would have had Nelson Rockefeller as president without being elected. But they failed to hit Ford. Anyway.
Wow. Very interesting. So another point that you touched on, are you saying that in 1792 that the founding fathers then came up with this constitution and then in there they slipped in that well-regulated militia thing there?
Well, they came up with the constitution that went into effect in 1789, the same year that the French Reign of Terror got going by Freemasons in France and the Freemasons in America, kind of got their acts together at the same time. But it was 1792 when the Militia Act was enacted. It was in two parts. When I was doing my research, you know, we didn't have the internet, and that's when I was writing the manuscript for this book in 1973. Wait a minute, am I, no, 19, I'm all screwed up. Let's see, the book came out in 1989, yeah. I did my research on the book in 1983, and I had to go to the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey to get the Militia Act of 1792. But I didn't know when I was reading it that there were two parts of this Militia Act. And luckily, I went back to postgraduate school, and on microfiche, I found the whole thing. But that's, you know, research in those days was pretty onerous compared to today, when you can just click a few buttons and look at anything you want to look at. Back then, you had to deal in paper and microfiche. If you were lucky enough to find a place that had, I mean, you can't go to the local library and find the Militia Act of 1792, I promise you. Not in the book. It's too arcane. It's too esoteric. But the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School had this. And I was lucky to find it. But, yeah, the Militia Act tried to control the American men who have all the guns. And the whole idea forever, see, all governments exist to control the people under them, everyone, without exception. And America had so many guns, even back then. Everybody had a gun. And the idea is how to control them. Well, they just kind of wrote this act, and nothing really came of the militia ever after. They voted to do a few ceremonial procedures and so forth, but the whole idea was to get a standing army. That's what Alexander Hamilton wanted, a standing army. Because why? Because he proposed a central bank, a privately controlled central bank, run by and owned by his Rothschild buddies in France and England. But you need to have a central bank, you have to have a central government, a dictatorship. In our case, posing as a democracy. Well, we don't have a democracy. We got minority rule, masquerading as majority rule, calling itself a democracy, but the minority rule, of course, the Jews and Freemasons that run America and always have. So anyway, that's the kind of thing we're up against here, just like everybody else in the world. And no country has done the damage to the world compared with what America has done to the world. First, really, in 1917, Woodrow Wilson and his cronies sent Trotsky from New York with 350 of his Jewish Mensheviks, the same time that Germany, with whom we just went to war a week earlier, April 1917, Germany, the German army sent Lenin and 150 of his Bolshevik Jews to meet Trotsky coming from New York to St. Petersburg. They had this experiment in democracy in Russia with Kerensky as the president, or prime minister, whatever he was. But when these two communists showed up in St. Petersburg, they kicked out Kerensky and took over the peaceful revolution and made it into a violent, bloody dictatorship. But that was because of America. America sent Trotsky, and German army sent Lenin. That's how we got communism. And then, of course, 1949, America put Mao Zedong in power in China, kicked out his erstwhile ally, Chiang Kai-shek. They went to the Timor and Matsu, or Taiwan. But America has communized every single communist country from the very beginning. And when I say America, I mean the Council on Foreign Relations. That's why all my writings since after the book came out was to destroy the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. I was desperate to get some men around me, you can't do it as one guy. I was doing everything I could as one guy. But when it comes to action, you want to have a lasting impact. You're going to have a bunch of guys with you. And, I mean, all over the country. That's why I wrote that book. It was the subtitle was A Call to Arms. The New American Man. Of course, that's a takeoff on the new Soviet man. So I called it The New American Man. Subtitle was A Call to Arms. And boy, was it. FBI came to see me one time in Montana. Because I took a bunch of machine guns up to Montana, and I armed the militia of Montana, not knowing that they were a federal FBI sting operation. Yeah. The FBI agent in charge of the militia of the United States came to see me in Montana. Wonder what I was doing, because I'd been out of it for about a year and a half. When I found out the militia in Montana, whom I armed with machine guns, Marine band radios, and money, because at least I thought they were doing something based on what I had written. Turns out it was just a federal trick. But when this agent, these agents came to my house, you should have seen it. It was unbelievable. They were shit scared, stammering, came under false pretenses, trying to make me think that they were interested in a business that I had that had been, I'd been defrauded of about $40,000. And somebody put me on the victim list, which was given to the FBI. They saw this as a wonderful opportunity to come see me. They knew that I'd armed the militia of Montana with all these high-quality machine guns. They knew I had the guns because I recovered them. Once I found out the militia of Montana was a federal sting operation, I gathered up all the guns back. I still had them, and these two agents came to my house. Man, you've never seen anybody stammering and nervous. It was quite a performance. But they admitted that, they knew I started the militia movement. There's a difference between the militia and the militia movement. The militia, the government said, morphed into the National Guard. And that's a big fat lie. Because the National Guard, the name is the Army National Guard of the United States. The National Guard is the U.S. Army. It's not the militia. They even had a television commercial Well, old Dave Lincoln, son of a bitch. Indian wrestling and splitting rails, and said if Abe Lincoln was in the militia, he wasn't in the militia, he was an attorney. Anyway, they were desperate to try to say that the militia was not the National Guard. Oh yeah, it's been an adventure for sure. I got attacked 3 times by the Israelis, tried to kill me. And probably two more times since then.
How did the Israelis try to kill you? What happened?
I was living in Las Vegas with my fiance. We got married in 2003. But we were down in the swimming pool at this in our apartment in Las Vegas on Flamingo. There was a group of six or seven men fairly nearby lounging around at the swimming pool. And my wife said to me, those men are Israelis. I said, how do you know? Well, I can hear them speaking Hebrew. They're always looking at you. My wife was a medical doctor, and she spent 13 or so years around Jews as a result of her education and so forth, her career. She said, I've been to Israel, and I hear them speaking in Hebrew, and they're always looking at you. You don't notice that? So I started looking at them, and sure enough, they were. Well, shortly after that, my truck was vandalized in the parking lot. And in the excitement, I didn't notice anything except all the junk that was scattered around. But a day later, I became very ill. My kidneys started to fail. And luckily, I was married to a very fine and innovative MD. And she put me on vitamin therapy and antibiotics. But it took about 6 weeks to recover, and I nearly croaked. It was touch and go. We got married after that 6 week ordeal. Went over to Carmel, California, got married in my hometown. Went back to Vegas. And what I was doing in Las Vegas was I developed a vehicle, an anti-landmine vehicle based on my experience in Rhodesia 20 years earlier. It's called the FLEA, Forward Light Escort Armored, FLEA. The Army hated that name. Right? They made me change the name to something more macho. But anyway, I had presented it to the Army in 1981, and it was rejected because it had fiberglass armor and skid steer, and the Tank Automotive Command in Michigan rejected it. But 20 years later, after Bush and Cheney, Rumsfeld attacked Iraq with the Humvee, the vehicle called the Humvee, and it was getting everybody killed and got in the Humvee because it had no armor protection whatsoever. So naively, I presented my design again to the Army. They rejected it for 20 years. The first time, in 81, when I responded to what they call a request for proposal, or RFP, for what became the Humvee, I presented my design, the FLEA, and I called the Tank Automotive Command about 6 weeks later, asking for a progress report on what they're going to choose to go with. The evaluator said, oh yes, the FLEA. I have that here. He looked at the papers. Oh, this is the skid steer, we don't, and it's armored. Yeah, I said, I know, but I'm within the weight requirements, and it's very powerful armor. Why don't you want to give them the protection? He said, no, we just want to have what we call psychological armor. Psychological armor, I said, does that mean they just think they're sitting behind armor? He kind of chuckled, like you are, and said, yeah, pretty much it. So why not give them the protection? Hold on. Somebody wants in.
Okay.
Hi, I'm on the phone. That was the first experience with these guys. For 20 years, they pretty much said the same thing. They didn't want something that wasn't made of steel. It steered like a car. Anyway, I got hooked up with a three star general, General Paul Kernan, who was the head of Army Material Command, and he fell in love with my design. And he made it happen. And Harry Reid was a U.S. Senator from Nevada. And I had a friend who lived in Las Vegas, so he said, well, come on over here, we'll present it to them from Las Vegas. So I did. I took the vehicle over there, and Harry Reid got behind it. I didn't know he was the number one, Israel's number one man in the U.S. Senate. I didn't know that. And Kern really pushed it, but he said to me one day, he said, yeah, I want you to work with a company called the Carlyle Group. I said, Carlyle Group? Yeah, he said, you get with them and we'll make this thing happen. Well, I didn't have the heart to tell General Allen, or General Kern, rather, Paul Kern. I didn't have the heart to tell him that the Secret Service had been to see me in Los Angeles. He said that if they ever see me near George Bush Sr., they would shoot me. In other words, take me down. The three agents came to my house. It's something I'd written about George Bush. And here, I couldn't tell this general that if I anywhere near George Bush, he'll kill me. Anyway, lots of stories, lots of experiences.
So, JB, okay, just to continue with some more of my questions. Let me just get here. Let's just talk about that story of yours about your design for a mine protected vehicle, and the military not going for it. I interviewed Fred Lucha. I don't know if you know about Fred Lucha. He was involved in the Zundel trial about the Holocaust.
Yeah, I know. I know all about it.
Okay. Well, Fred Lucha did a lot of work for states in America and for the U.S. military, and he built execution machines. Well, and he was also telling me about things that he tendered for. He did get some tenders for jobs, but then there was also a time when he tendered and then suddenly everything disappears, they ignore it, and somebody else gets the business. And it looks to me like there are some dirty things that go on there. And you know, your experience reminds me of things that my friends have done. I've had friends here in Africa who've tried various things. I've also seen business ideas where people try to go to governments and things, and most of the time the common man is just screwed, man. And he's just screwed. If you're not in with them, you're not one of their bum chums, you're not going to get it. And you know, the thing that amazes me is that America is supposed to be built on a meritocracy. That America is about getting stuff done. If you are good, you're supposed to move onwards and upwards. But in reality, that doesn't seem to be the case. vast majority of Americans seem, white Americans seem to lose out, and the people who get in there are the Jews and the Freemasons and all those types of people. Very similar to here.
Yeah, I mean, I had it made. There wasn't any question that this thing was going to work. Harry Reid was essentially my business partner. He set it up so that the plea was going to be accepted, and it was going to go into production, and the production was going to be done in Reno, or Sparks, which is just east of Reno. And they had the company all picked out, the Nevada Automotive Test Center out in Fallon area, or between Carson City and Fallon, was going to do the redesign of the basic, of my basic design, make it even better. It was a done deal. So we, my partner and I, flew back to Washington, D.C., met with Reed, and met with General Kern and others. When we came back to Las Vegas, I called Rich Verma, who was Senator Reed's legal counsel. He said, "We can't do business with you." I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you've been investigated and found to be anti-Semitic."
"Are you serious? They said that to you?"
"Oh yeah, Rich Berman said it to me on the phone." I said, "You mean my politics are more important than the safety of the troops?" He said, "In this case, yes." Sure enough, Israelis run for, oh, I didn't tell you, but the second time they tried to kill me, after the first time, I didn't know how they got me. I had no idea. But 6 weeks later, after I was married now, and I'd recovered from the first attempt on me, my partner and I got in my truck. He was chatting away. We were going to go over and see the vehicle because the Army guys were coming the next day. We wanted to make sure everything was tip-top shape. We got in my truck, and I put my hands in the steering wheel, and the steering wheel was coated in grease. The whole thing was coated in grease. And my friend was talking. I said, "Hey, what is this?" He kind of glanced at it. Didn't really pay attention to what I was saying because he was talking so much. My hands were greasy. And oh, not only did my kidneys almost stop entirely in the 6 weeks previous, but there was this horrible burn on my dick. So whatever I had in my hands, you pulled out the pee, you get it on your dick, and this burn wouldn't stop. And it was really severe. And it kind of, my wife could handle the disease, but she couldn't really do anything about my personal problem. We didn't know what it was. So the second time, put my hands in the grease. The first time there was no grease in my wheel that I could detect, but of course my truck had been vandalized, so I didn't really notice anything except the mess that they made. But this time, there was no mess, just mess on my steering wheel. It was grease. So he just wouldn't shut up, so I just picked up a shop rag, wiped my hands off, and we went over and checked out the vehicle. And the Army guys came the next day, but I was starting to get sick again. And sure enough, it was the real deal. And I got even sicker than I did the first time, and the burn on my dick was even worse. I mean, it was unbelievable. Very painful, as you can imagine. It wouldn't heal. It wouldn't stop. And it spread. Put quite a dent in my love life. So 6 weeks again went by, and I recovered from the poisoning. And then my wife and I went out one day. I started parking the truck next to the guard shack at the apartment complex that we lived in. And I asked the guard to keep an eye on it because somebody was messing with my truck. He said he would. Nevertheless, we went out one morning. At this point, I was wiping all surfaces that I might touch with alcohol before I touched them, or I wore gloves, or both. Same with my wife. She was wearing gloves. And I would, you know, carefully swab off anything, door handles or steering wheel. But this time we got in the truck, and again, despite the fact that it was next to the guard shack and locked, the steering wheel was coated with this grease again. I didn't touch it, of course. I said, hey, look, they've done it again. So I went to the police this time.
You didn't? Yes, I was going to ask, did you go to the cops?
I did. We went to the cops, the Las Vegas PD. And they said, well, who do you suspect? Well, I said, I got a threatening email this morning from the Jewish Defense League, so I kind of suspect them, or the Israelis. My wife heard him speaking Hebrew before my first attack. Well, if you say anything about Jews in Las Vegas, forget it, because Las Vegas is a totally Jewish town. And they said, no, get out of here. So, the deal finally fell through with Harry Reid and the U.S. Army. So we left. There was no reason to live in Las Vegas anymore. We went elsewhere. But then... Go ahead.
If I may ask you, when you say Harry Reid, are you talking about the Harry Reid, I think, who was the governor of a state?
Senator.
And is this the Harry Reid who's a Mormon?
Well, I don't know if he's a Mormon. I guess he could be, but he's an Israel firster, and he was considered at the time, according to my research, Israel's most valuable guy in the Senate. He was a minority leader and a majority leader, I think, whenever the Democrats were in power.
Because I used to know a woman who lived in that area, in that state, in Nevada, and she was very into politics, and she said to me that Harry Reid is the most corrupt politician in America.
That's the guy. That's the one. He was my business partner.
So you knew Harry Reid personally?
Well, I'd have to say I didn't know him, but we were associates. You know, I mean, he was making it all happen. He had a military attaché, and he had his legal counsel. We bet and all. But I didn't consult with him. I consulted with his cutout guys.
Okay. So he was going to make everything happen.
He was really going to be there. Yeah, not only that, but... this was in 2003. He made a deal with the Army that if they would proceed with the funding immediately and apply for immediate funding for this production of the flea, due to the serious nature of everybody getting blown up in Iraq, the Humvees being so ill-suited for IEDs and general ambush. So the Army said, okay, we'll get it going this year, in 2004, at the end of 2003. And he said, okay, I'll pay you back in 2005, so we'll get this thing going right now. It's an emergency. And the Army said, yeah, we agree. So... yeah, it was a real lesson in American real politics, for sure.
So, in other words, he's gonna make money out of your deal.
Oh hell yeah! No question. There was a billion, billions of dollars we're talking about. They were gonna. The Army told me that they were going to replace all the frontline Humvees with this vehicle, the flea. Of course, I had to rename it to Lance, L-A-N-C-E. Sounded much more macho than the flea. I like flea. That was pretty good. Forward light escort armored. The fleas are pretty irritating. But they wanted his name Lance. So I called it Lance for Light Armored Non-Metallic Combat Escort. That's what Lance stood for. He just dreamed it up.
And what, just out of curiosity, because I always love military stuff, just out of curiosity, what did you, you obviously used lessons that you'd learned from Rhodesia.
Totally.
Totally. And can you maybe describe the vehicle a little bit, the design of the vehicle a little bit? What?
I'll send you a picture of it.
Oh, wow. Yes, yes. Send me a picture. This sounds very fascinating.
Yeah,
so did you build, you built like a prototype?
Yeah. Yeah, they wanted some changes, immediate changes. They wanted 6 wheels instead of 4 wheels. It was not tracked because the whole idea of landmines is to break the tank tracks. So I realized that you have to have wheels. You can blow up one wheel, and if you have a good suspension, or in this case, 6 wheels instead of 4, you just lose the one wheel, and you got skid steer. It means you steer with one side going faster than the other side. It's like a caterpillar, like any track vehicle. So it had to be a wheeled vehicle, and it was fiberglass armor, very powerful fiberglass armor, much better than steel. Very lightweight. Anyway, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, that'll be really good to look at. Oh, wow. Yeah, very, very interesting, JB. Just fascinated. So if I understand you correctly, when you left Rhodesia, which I suspect was around about 1974 or so, that when you returned to America, you now had this whole Rhodesian thing in your head, and how soon was it before you started doing things and started looking at militia and started realizing that you got problems in America?
Well, the problem started for me in 1980 when I was arrested for the machine gun. Oh,
did you get one of these?
Not yet. I'm on the phone. Thanks.
Awesome. I'll come back and grab it.
Okay. Sorry. In 1980, when I got prosecuted for the submachine gun, and we both got off, but boy, it took a year. And it was during this time that I designed the flea. Nothing better to do, waiting for trial. And by 1981, I submitted it to the Army for the Humvee program. I forget the nature of your question.
Yeah, I was just trying to get, let me ask you another question related to this. That machine gun thing. The submachine gun thing. So you were going to kill Rockefeller. So how did they arrest you for a plot to go and kill somebody, or did they arrest you because you had like an illegal weapon? Or and when you're saying you were waiting for trial, were you in jail?
No, we'd been released on our own recognizance, despite the fact that it was a serious felony. You know, possession of a submachine gun in California is very serious. But we had no criminal record, so that's your option. The first time you get arrested, you probably get released on your own recognizance. You haven't jumped bail anyplace. If you hadn't had any criminal experience. So we were at large for that year leading up to the trial. And I had the time to design this vehicle.
So this is the vehicle based on your Rhodesian design. So this is a six-wheeled vehicle.
Right.
With sloping armor, and what are those? Are those ports for guns?
Yeah, those are chain guns on there.
Oh, this is so cool. This is your stuff, so I assume you wouldn't want this published, but I could publish the image.
Oh, it's the whole thing if you want. That's, it's
I think,
a dead duck, but it's very interesting. It's a pretty innovative.
I think it's fucking awesome. And this is based on the Rhino.
Exactly.
And it's much better. And I think with those chain guns, that would have been fucking deadly. Eh? Oh man.
Oh yeah. Oh, it was a great design. You know, it's still very innovative. But the problem is, John.
So if I may interrupt you, so your design is it blows one of the wheels away and the vehicle can still run.
It can blow three of them away and still run, as long as there's one on each side. Doesn't matter which ones. They're all independent.
That is awesome. That is awesome. I like your vehicle. And the interesting
thing was, the designer, me, and the engineer, a guy named John Martin, we were both blown up by TM-46 landmines. He in Vietnam and me in Rhodesia. So the first time you ever had a couple of guys involved in something that were both recipients of the explosions that we're talking about. You know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That went over pretty well with the Army. They liked that. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, man. That thing, that's way better than the Humvee, man. Oh, wow.
It's safe.
That's very cool.
See, it allows you to get away from the kill zone. The whole thing is to get out of the kill zone. What a landmine does is stop you right where you are, and you're subject to being shot or whatever, captured, if you survive the explosion. But in this thing, you can just keep going. That's the whole beauty of it.
Wow, that is very cool. That is very nice. I like it.
Those are General Electric chain guns. They're pretty neat. You can't believe the cooperation I got. Yeah, I'm here.
You were saying they are General Electric chain guns.
Yeah. They were actually Lockheed Martin or McDonnell Douglas took over by the time we got the guns, but they were GE. I think GE had the first chain guns. Maybe I'm missing something. You know, it was Hughes Aircraft had the first chain guns, and then they were bought out by McDonnell Douglas, and that's who I was dealing with, was McDonnell Douglas for the guns. Same guy.
Don't chain guns have an insane rate of fire?
Yeah, not compared with, say, a minigun. The Gatling guns are much higher rate of fire. But the thing with a chain gun is, even if you got a dud, it'll just spit it out and keep going until it finds a round that's good. Run by electricity rather than gas or blowback. Quite innovative.
Man, this is cool. I will publish this. This is awesome. I love it. So just to clarify, when they caught you with I just want to get through the story of when they caught you with the, was it a submachine gun?
Yeah, Thompson, 1942 Thompson submachine gun.
Now, what exactly were they arresting you for? Were they arresting you for plotting to kill somebody? Or were
they? I never mentioned that. They suspected that. They accused me in the newspapers of being a hired assassin. But obviously, I wasn't hired by anybody. I was just an assassin.
a lone assassin, a self-motivated assassin.
Have gun, will travel.
Have own gun, will go and put some powerful people in the ground.
I tell you, Rhodesia had a hell of an effect on me. I mean, I really had a case of the red ass, and I was so furious at what America had done to Rhodesia, I never got over it. Still haven't.
Is that so? Because it's good that you raised that thing, because I've sat and thought so much, especially as I was now also relooking South Africa and so forth. And you know, the thing that eats me up as well, JB, is to think that here are the whites in Southern Africa willing to fight the Russians and the Chinese. And we're willing to fight the enemies of America. We're fighting the same fucking people that you guys were fighting in Vietnam, the same fucking people that you guys were fighting in Korea, and now America doesn't even want to give us weapons or nothing. It's not even give us weapons. It's we will buy anything we can lay our fucking hands on. And the British and the Americans cut off supplies of weapons to us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Rhodesia was a real learning experience for me, obviously, for everybody who was involved in it. But it was so sad. So, I'm drawn to intimidation or bullies, like a moth is to a bright light. I can't resist it. And Rhodesia was the ultimate case of being outnumbered. A combination of America, England, Soviet Union, and Red China. How can you beat that combination when you got 250,000 people, 270,000 people?
Yeah. I mean, we were so few that the total white population of Rhodesia would fit into just a town in America. I don't think even a city.
That's right. Well, city, probably small city.
Yeah, yeah, and nobody wants to help us. Only the South Africans, the Portuguese, the French. Any help that we got was European related.
Right.
The Europeans were the only ones who actually tried to lift a finger, with the French and the Portuguese at the top of the list. But I mean, it's so disgusting. You know, I was sitting and thinking about America, because even in the South African context, And looking at things like Katanga, I don't know if you've studied other African history, where whites were starting to fight back before Rhodesia and before the Portuguese, there were some fight backs that started. The one was the British doing a bit against the Mau Mau in Kenya, but the most interesting was Katanga in the Congo,
right.
And America comes in on the side of the United Nations, and the United Nations attacks the freaking Katangese, and they're fighting whites in Africa who are fighting communists, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on with America?
The same as always, America is a deception. America is the enemy of mankind, this Civil War, so-called Civil War, Abraham Lincoln's War. That's when America became a monster. In World War I, well, before that, Philippines, Spanish-American War, that was a horrible atrocity. We killed 1 million Filipinos. Nobody knows about that. In World War One. My God. Just the wholesale slaughter of men in one battle. I mean, you lose more in one battle than Rhodesia had in its entire existence. That's how bad World War One was. We don't even talk about it.
Yes. And then, of course, I actually did a video recently about the Germans. The Germans, 90% of the German army was busy fighting the fucking Soviet Union. And then along come the British and the Americans, the Anglo-American world, and they come and they invade Europe and knife the Germans in the back, over and above the fact that they've been bombing the shit out of the Germans. But you know, when I look at the moves of Britain and America, it is so disgusting. It's no wonder that whites as a race are in the state that we're in. But I put it down to the fact that Britain and America are like Jewish colonies.
Right. Well, you can really trace it all to the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm interested in solutions. That's why I was willing to kill these guys. I believe in solutions. I don't want to complain without a proposal or a suggestion what to do about it. Everything I write, I have to have that in there. Otherwise, you're just demoralizing people. You got to come up with an idea on how to fix this problem. That was one good thing about Americans. I mean, we're pretty naive people and pretty stupid in many ways, but they had this can-do attitude about, you know, putting a railroad across the country. Pretty amazing feat in the 1860s. Empire State Building, Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, that's a pretty wild, the Wright brothers. Oh, my God. The things that this country did do, and they were good. But everything was turned against humanity. Everything America did that was good, Wright brothers, Henry Ford, it always led to killing people. And the ultimate target of these bastards is the American people. Everybody else is a sideshow, as far as they're concerned. As far as I'm concerned, everybody's important. But not to these bastards in New York. They want to kill. And there's something horrible about these people. They get off on killing and making people suffer. So that's why I wrote that book. I knew about these guys. I knew before I went to Rhodesia. My dad said, "You better get out of the country. You're too hot. I'm going to kill Henry Kissinger." My God. Okay, I'll go to Rhodesia. Get some experience. Came back, I was even hotter. Yeah,
because now you've seen the results of
treachery.
Of America's treachery. Stuff.
Yeah, America's foreign policy.
You know, white people have been losing for the last century, more than a century. The white race has been losing, and it's been going downwards. Like another thing that I ponder a lot are the European empires. You know, Europe dominated most of the world, and then in some of my reading relating to World War II, going through some of David Irving's stuff, there is Roosevelt. And Roosevelt even openly tells the British that the British Empire is not going to exist in the future. America is not going to support the British Empire. So, I mean, the British are destroying other people's colonies. America comes and helps to put the knife in Britain. At the end of the day, all the Europeans lose everything. You know, white people, white people prior to World War One, World War Two, probably dominated 75% was of the planet's surface, and it's all fucking gone, and it's gone in like 100 years. How did we go so backwards? But when I look at it, there's Jews in there, there is America in there, there's Russia in there, and it's so sad to me personally. The loss of the European colonies is one of the greatest fucking disasters of all. It's almost as terrible as the disaster known as World War II. What a disaster that was. And all these things, it's whites that are losing. It's whites that are getting killed. It's whites that are becoming weaker.
I got an assignment one time when I was in support unit. The boss said, Campbell, I want you to go out when you go on patrol again. I want you to go to Chester Tribal Trust Land and find the American mission there. I said, what for? I want you to tell them to stop doing what they're doing and helping the terrorists. Oh, I said, then you better find somebody else. No, Campbell, you're American and they're Americans. I want you to go in and try to talk them out of this thing. Okay. So that time I got to Mount Darwin and see my friend Kenneth, who's Vandermeerwe, Willem Vandermeerwe. Did I tell you this story already?
Go ahead and tell it again, because this is one of the questions I was going to ask you anyway. This is worthy of a video by itself. So go ahead, talk all you want. I'll ask you some questions.
So Willem said, okay, I'll shut the mechanic store down and go with you. I wanted a white guy to go with me because all I had were some Africans, six Africans in the back of my pickup. Subordinate guy. So Willem got in with me and we went off into Chester, which was a highly dangerous place to go anyway. But I had to find this mission. So one of my men knew where it was. So we rolled in there. The little American gal came out, a dumpy looking thing. Can I help you? Oh, yes, ma'am. I want to see the missionary. He's not here. Oh, when's he coming back? Well, later. I see. Okay, well, I'm here. I better talk to you then. I said, very well. He said, come inside. So Willem and I went inside. My men stayed out in the truck. And brought them tea, of course. First thing, gave them tea before they gave us tea. Probably the first tea these guys ever had. Anyway, she finally came in. We were sitting in the vestibule there. And he said, how can I help you? Well, ma'am, I said, I've been asked to come see you. I'm an American, too, just like you. She said, no, I didn't know this. And anyway, I've been asked to ask you, please, to stop helping the terrorists when they come here. We killed or captured terrorists with the hospital bracelet on their arms. Well, we have to help anyone in need. Yeah, I understand. I said, I understand. But you're probably helping them in other ways, too. And that's what we're asking you to stop doing. Otherwise, there may be consequences. I was bluffing. She knew I was bluffing. There aren't going to be any consequences. Okay, taking the missionaries out of Rhodesia. African children were taken to the sixth grade by the missions. The mission school did all the educating of African tribesmen. Took them to the sixth grade. They taught them to read and write in their own language, read and write in English. And then they kicked them out and said, okay, you're educated. Go out and find your way in life. So the missions really are taking them to the sixth grade. Created a great deal of dissatisfaction because it takes them just so far, and then they can see what they're missing. And it created unrest. Besides the fact that almost all the missions were pro-communist, which is, you know, this is the way it is. Liberal. And anyway, she said, well, it's our duty to help them. I said, ma'am, it's not your duty to help terrorists. These people are so vicious. They're cutting people's feet off and cutting their lips off and their noses and their ears and making wife cook and eat them. They're not people, they're monsters. She said, well, they love us. I said, now come on, oh, come on. I said, you know, they don't love anybody. Africans don't even have a word for love in the south of the Sahara, as far as I know. We've learned to love through our Christian teachings. Okay. I said, now what's going to happen is, if they're ordered to kill you, which they may well be at some point, if they don't kill you because they love you, and somebody's going to kill them, and somebody who doesn't love you is going to come here and kill you. That's just the way it is. So we agreed to disagree, and I blew them a knife up. They were themselves killed about 6 months later.
Now, what kind of arguments did she give you as to why she believed that the blacks wouldn't kill them?
Because they learned to love them through their Christian teachings. Brother coughed, you know, just like okay. you laughed. He had to cough to keep from laughing. He was very polite, though.
You know, that by itself is another topic for later. So when they were killed, did you go back there when they'd been killed? Tell me a bit about their killing. Did you go back to the mission? Did you find out more? Did they tell you how they were killed, when they were killed?
The missionary and his wife were both killed. The woman I was talking to was killed, stabbed with bayonets. Oh.
Bayoneted to death.
Yeah, and that's their favorite way. It's quiet. We're around someplace, we don't hear anything. That was a usual way of killing. One time I was chasing this guy. His name was Kid, K-I-D. Kid Morong Rong, and his sidekick. They were a couple of psychos. They were so psycho that even the other terrorists wouldn't let them be with them because they were so psycho. But we were always about 4 hours behind this guy. And we followed him into this village, this crawl. And there's a whole bunch of Africans in a big circle, big gang of, and we find my leading men part of the waves of people. We made our way into the center of this thing, and there was an African lying around with his legs chopped off. He was lying there smoking a cigarette. Holy Christ, I said, what happened to you? Well, Kid had come in with his sidekick. He fished a piece of paper out of his pocket, pretended that he was reading something. He said, what crawl is this? I told him, you have a headman named John? Yes, I'm John. Oh, you're John. Well, you've been helping the police reserve. Ah, Nicky's, I found him. Ah, so he got some tribesmen to lay this guy on his back, put a log under one leg, pick up the sauna near the axe, whack, chopped off his leg at right below the knee, put it on the other leg, chop, 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 chop that one off. Threw the axe on him, says, there, that'll help you. That'll teach you to help the police. So there's 4 hours later, we come in and he's smoking a cigarette. I never saw anything like that in my life. If there'd been a white man, we'd have been dead 3.5 hours earlier. These Africans are unbelievable.
I was going to ask, if they've chopped his legs off below the knee, isn't his blood just pumping out? He should be dead. Or did they patch it, or what did they do?
I guess they had strings around his his thighs for tourniquet. I was so shocked. We called the helicopter. The helicopter came and got him. We put him and his feet and his legs on the helicopter, and off he went to Harare General Hospital. You know, the really jacked up hospital in Salisbury was Harare.
Yes.
The one for the whites was kind of old fashioned, but the latest technology was at Harare Hospital. So that's where he took him. And by God, they sewed that one leg back on. There's a picture of him in a book called Rhodesia by Robin Moore. Robin Moore was over there after I left, and he wrote a book called Rhodesia. And there's a picture of John in a wheelchair in his bathrobe. He's got one leg sewed back on. The other one was too damaged. Couldn't help him on that one. But he got one leg back on. Somebody killed Kid and his sidekick. We didn't get him. I never got him. Somebody got him. And they got a picture of Kid and his sidekick propped up against the wall, dead bodies. And there's John in a wheelchair spitting on Kid for chopping off his legs. I mean, they're like deer, you know. You can shoot one of them, and if you didn't kill him, they'd take off like a deer. And, oh my God, the punishment they could take was unbelievable.
So the blacks are tough.
Oh, tougher than boot leather, I'll tell you. They're really tough. I have to admire them for that. They didn't care. It's a tough life, you know. But obviously they can't do anything. They can't take care of themselves. They have to be subsidized. They may be like tougher than animals, but they're not much smarter than animals either.
And then what you have is you got a bunch of Jews and liberals who come along, and then they carry on and on and on about how we whites treat those blacks. But if you see how those blacks treat each other and how nasty it is, then the way that whites are treating them is like nothing. You'd agree?
Yeah, did you ever find that book? Yeah, I do. Did you ever find that book I mentioned to you last time by Christopher Mack and called The Silent War? Fred Shea and Christopher Mack. They wrote this thing back in 71. And that's where I got a lot of information before I went back to Rhodesia the second time. It had just come out in 71. All the troops stopping at the bookstore, jumping off the trucks and going inside and get a copy of this book. And so I went back and got one too. And that's where I learned about Joshua Nkomo. I never heard of Joshua Nkomo, otherwise I never would have heard of him, but he described in that book. As I said, I never did hear of Robert Mugabe when I was there. It was in Dabaningi Sotoli was the head of ZANU when I was there.
Yeah. Well, JB, I think a couple of things before we wind up for today is tell me a little bit about the starting of the militia movement in America. You say you started it. Are you saying that you started getting guys together and forming militia units? Just tell me a bit about how the militia got started.
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. Because, well, I'll tell you how it started. for some reason, I can't remember now why, but a radio station in Anchorage, Alaska, KEAG, started calling me asking for comments on this or that. And that was about the time I was, this was in 1982. And so I'd give my comments on this or that. But this was about the time I was starting to write this book, The New American Man. And I was getting pretty knowledgeable about things like the militia, the real militia, not the militia movement, which I started. So at one point I mentioned to the talk show host guy, he said, well, I'm writing a book about what I'm proposing. Oh, really? I'd like to, hear about it. Yeah, I said, I'm going to the New American Man, Call to Arms, and no, it was later than that, because I'd already written the thing. It came out in January of 1989. That's when it, I went to Anchorage. The whole militia movement started in Anchorage, Alaska, which people find hard to find belief. But it's because this radio show kept calling me for comments on something. I finally started saying what I wanted to do, and they ordered several cases of my book when it was available. So it became available in January 1989, and it emanated. Just spread from Anchorage down to the lower 48 very quickly. And the militia movement started within a couple of months in 1989, early 1989. But there was, no, I didn't sign anybody up. There was nothing to join. It was totally a state of mind. And that's what made me so dangerous. I finally realized not too long ago, what made me so dangerous to the FBI, the CIA, because William Colby, the head of CIA, even retired, but he wrote this guy, this Nebraska attorney that was in the killing program in Vietnam with him. What's his name? Anyway, he said, you know, this militia movement is much more dangerous to us than we think, because people that are in it our society's normal, successful citizens. That was kind of true. I mean, there's nothing to join. It was all a big trick on my part. And but it, something about it struck a chord, and it made the government extremely fearful because they couldn't stop it. They had nothing to stop it with. They couldn't make us look into boogeyman until, as I said, Oklahoma City, that stopped it, 1995.
So you're saying that from the time of your book until Oklahoma City bombing, that about 5 million people were gathering in militias?
Well, that's the government estimate, but that was 2 years before Oklahoma City, so it probably got even bigger than that. By the time of Waco, when people were burned to death, that's when the government announced it was about 5 or 6 million estimated. But it was 2 years later, 1995, April 19th, 1995, that Oklahoma City got blown up by CIA, FBI. Now, I have to say something about FBI. I called them many, many times. The number one, America's number one terrorist organization. Why do I say that? Because they've always been a gangster operation with a crazy, insane, homosexual transvestite, Octoroon, Clark Black, director, J. Edgar Hoover, from the very beginning to 1972, when he was probably murdered. Anyway, In 1980, in February 1993, the Federal Bureau of Investigation supplied the bomb that blew up the World Trade Center in 1993. If you recall, it killed 6 people, injured about 1,000. $1.5 billion in damages, parking structure underneath the, I think it was the North Tower. It was horrendous, but it was an FBI bomb because their informant was an Egyptian officer named Imad Ali Salem. And he infiltrated this ragtag bunch of angry people. And the FBI just, James Fox, a special agent in charge of New York, John Antisev, Nancy Floyd, dealt directly with Imad Salem. And they said, okay, here's what we want you to do. You've been infiltrated just a bunch of guys. So I said, yeah. And what are they like? What's their attitude? Oh, they're very angry. Okay. You think they bomb anything? Bomb? Well, no, they don't know how to make a bomb. But you're ex-army, you know how to make a bomb. Mm-hmm. Okay, we want you to make a bomb, but we want you to use phony explosive. We'll supply the phony plastic or whatever. And when you plant it, then you tell us where you planted it and when they're going to be there, and we'll arrest it, the terrorists. Okay. A few weeks later, the NSF and Floyd met with Salem again. Now, we know this. A guy called me up from Time Magazine one time. He said, I just said you know something about the New York bombing, World Trade Center bombing. He said, yeah, you know where I learned it? Nowhere. The New York Times. What? New York Times, how did I miss that? Well, it's easy. It was on page 47. Oh, I'll send it to you. Nancy Floyd and John Nesisev were being secretly recorded by Imad Ali Salem every time they met with him. He was hot. Had a long wire. He recorded. And they said, okay, change the plans. Imad, you're going to use real explosives. The phone explosives won't do us any good. And so when we find that bomb with the real explosives in it, then we can arrest it. Okay, so make sure I understand this. You want me to make them a bomb with real explosives? Yes. Okay. So he did. That's the one that blew up. It was an FBI bomb, which makes them America's number one terrorist organization, without a question.
I'm with you. I am aware of that, of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and those issues, and I am aware of Timothy McVeigh being let's call it abused. There's a lovely documentary called A Noble Lie, and yeah. In that documentary they discuss the Oklahoma City bombing. And now that I understand the blowing up of the towers on 9/11, it's clearly the same thing. There are eyewitnesses who saw people working and placing explosives inside that building like a week or two before this thing happened. So there are like levels of betrayal. There are like people who trick people who trick people. And then you get a guy like Timothy McVeigh. He thinks he's doing one thing. Meanwhile, something else is going down. And he's the fall guy who takes the beating. I did read that that the truck he had what is it? Fertilizer for the explosives, and that there's no ways that a truckload of fertilizer can destroy a building that strong, and that right. You know it's like a precursor to 9/11. You know, all the same old stuff. You know, people think that right. His truck bomb did it, but it wasn't. JB, I think there's just maybe one other thing. The Clintons are scum. The Clintons are such scum. You know something else I came across about the Oklahoma City bombing that I only picked up a lot later was, do you know that there was a whole bunch of stuff that they were going to impeach Clinton, Bill Clinton, with. And I'm not sure if it was Whitewater stuff. Do you know that, listen to this, that just sort of by accident, that all that stuff of Whitewater also was in that building, and when that explosion went off, it destroyed all the evidence for the impeachment of Clinton.
By the sheerest of coincidence.
Yeah, isn't that an amazing coincidence? It's like that disgusting Jew of the World Trade Center, old Lucky Larry, who he and his children just, they're there every morning for breakfast, except on the day of the explosion. Well, this stuff about all of Clinton's Whitewater stuff was in that building, and it went up. So when I look at like Oklahoma City bombing, it's like there's a whole bunch of things. There's a whole ton of coincidences that all happen together, and it works out so wonderfully for the Clintons. It's so sophisticated. You cannot tell me that there's no ways in a billion years that any of this is an accident. There are people betraying other people, working with other people. It's freaking crazy. So that Oklahoma City bombing. So you're saying that by implicating Timothy McVeigh and the militia movement, that is what scared people out of the militia movement.
Overnight.
Wow. That is disgusting.
Yep.
And so.
Now I got you something more disgusting. That's something even more disgusting. And I don't know if you have enough material now for this, if you want to do it next time, but.
I think.
I have a personal story about Oklahoma City.
I think let us continue with those things in our next chat. But
okay,
then let's call it a day for today. Then I'll make a note next time.
Oh, I was personally betrayed by my dear friend over this thing.
Okay.
Andrea Strassmeyer.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? Have you ever read the book, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton?
Oh, yeah.
That thing, that book had lots of stuff in there, and I remember that name from there. Okay, JB, well, we've done some good stuff today, and we'll be back again. And I look forward to chatting to you more about that.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know.